Hello there! This show contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress. The language and concepts contained herein will not cause eternal torment in the place where the guy with the horns and pointed stick conducts his business.
Dude, man, what's going on?
You hear that?
That is the sound of John snorting cocaine.
Yes.
No, I don't. No more.
No, that's the sound of my sinuses being clear. The Kraken be gone.
Yeah. We missed a week because John's chest was being sat upon by the Kraken.
It's funny you brought up Ringo Starr.
Why is it funny? Well, it is funny that I brought up Ringo Starr. Ringo's a funny guy.
Did you hear about what he did recently?
No, what did Ringo do?
I guess he and his new band, the guy's like 67 years old. He and his new band, they were on Regis and Kathy Lee or whatever her name is.
Is it like
Regis
the Ringo All-Star Band or is it something different than
no,
that?
No, it's Ringo and the Wankers or something. I have no idea what the band
no,
is.
No, that was the Beatles.
It doesn't even matter what the band is because it was Ringo. And they were playing some new single off his new album. And they wanted him to cut it short, you know, basically, yeah, you got a 4-minute song there. Can you cut it down to like 2.5? And he was saying, no, I don't want to cut it. So he's in the middle of playing it. And then they were like giving him a signal to cut it. So he and his band walked off the show in the middle of the show.
Oh, good. Well, that goes back to the 60s when
like I'm Ringo.
On the Ed Sullivan show, they asked the Rolling Stones not to sing. Let's spend the night together. They wanted him to say, let's spend some time together or something like that. You know? Yeah, I thought we were beyond that. And like Elvis Costello was told not to play that radio song on Saturday Night Live.
And they wanted to film Elvis from the waist up.
And they did. They did do that, actually, so you couldn't see his gyrating hips. Yeah. So, hey.
So he said, I'm going. Goodbye.
Well, good for them. That's cool.
Yeah.
So you know what? I got my taxes done the other day. And you know how much I paid?
$1 million.
Zero.
You paid zero.
Yeah, I got a friend who's a preparer at H&R Block. And
he's a preparist.
She's a preparator. And normally they do family and friends for $20, so I was prepared to pay 20, but then her boss brought over a coupon and said, I'll give you this $20 off coupon if you buy Margie a cup of coffee. And I said, okay, that sounds like a fair deal.
So what you're saying is that the preparation costs were zero. You paid taxes during the year.
Yeah. No, I'm saying to have my taxes prepared, it cost me zero, and I'm a little excited about that because the fee would have been $130 because my taxes are getting a little bit more complicated than they used to be, so they got to do more forms and schedules and forms and blah blah blah.
Yeah, well, that's how it is, and this year, like all years, I choose to do this software because I don't trust people.
Well, I do because they guarantee they'll show up with me and justify how they prepared my taxes for me. And all that. And, you know, I love numbers. I love arithmetic. I love mathematics. But to me, accounting is dreck. It's torture.
It's not math.
Exactly. I love the way mathematics apply to the world. But, you know, fractals, things like that.
Well, one of the things that they do in the tax software is they go through and they ask you questions. And one of them's like, you know, do any of your children have a birthmark underneath her left thigh? And was it a full moon when your first child was born? And then they give you different deductions based on all of that. And yeah,
you know, if you conceive under the northern lights, your children will be geniuses.
I guess it worked.
There you go. Hey, what are we drinking today?
One of the things that we're drinking is this Italian stuff. It's a 2001 Citra Montepulciano d'Abruzzo.
Now, for someone who is Italian, not you, but if an Italian person were here and saying that, what would they say?
They would say Montepulciano d'Abruzzo.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, that was a gift, actually, from my parents. And it's a little sweeter than what we normally drink, but it's not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And I'm going to finish off another bottle that I've got here.
Speaking of my parents, every year my dad, who is a big train buff.
He buffs trains?
No, he doesn't buff trains, but he holds a collector's swap meet, you know, like Lionel Electric Trains, down at historic Union Station. He actually has a swap meet in our train station, which is like a 1920s, you know, what style is it?
Old.
Yeah, it's got 20s. That Grand Central Station.
A lot of marble everywhere.
Yeah, a lot of marble, you know,
those
giant
wooden
pillars.
Slat chairs.
Yep.
It's a really cool place.
And since last weekend, John and I weren't able to do a show because of the Kraken, I had Sunday free. In other words, I normally do some editing and do some other things on Sunday, and my dad's train show was on Sunday. So I went down with the little portable handheld Zoom H4 handheld recorder that I bought so John and I could kind of go in the field and do stuff. And I used it once before for the show when I did the Chris thing, the little segment where she was criticizing your politics and and all that good stuff about your hateful pro-life views.
Yes, my love of life has been turned around into hate.
Exactly. So this is actually the second time I used it for the show. In my move, I lost it, but it just reared its ugly head, and I brought it down the Union Station, and I did three segments, and we're going to play the first one for you now, and I'll just suffice it to say there are two things I need to tell you. I approached these segments with humor, and secondly, because I don't have a lot of experience with this handheld recorder yet, I didn't know how loudly to speak, and I was talking really loudly into it to kind of make my voice that much louder than the background noise. Yeah. So my voice distorts every once in a while.
Only he experimented by putting it in his throat.
Yeah, and my voice distorts a little bit, so I have to apologize for that. But in the future, I'll know how to use this tool a little better. And yeah, I don't know. I think they're pretty funny. Why don't you play them, John? Play segment one. Here I am at Utica's historic Union Station for the, how many annual?
28th
annual Utica Toy Train Meet, or what's it really called?
The Utica Toy Train Collectors Meet.
Right. And looks like you got a pretty good crowd today. How many people do you usually get through the doors for this event?
Anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500.
It seems like it's gone down a little. Didn't you get more like 4,000 the first year?
Well, the first year is when we started this off, yes, they really packed it in here. Why? I don't know.
I see a lot of people around here dressed in silly suits. Is this a Halloween event, too?
Well, no. Everybody's got their railroad costumes on today.
Does anybody... You wouldn't happen to know if Tom Cruise was a member of this club, because as far as I know, train collecting has been associated with cult-like activity.
No, I don't believe Tom Cruise is a member of this club.
Well, we'll talk to you later. Well, and there you go. That was segment number one.
Now, train collectors are notoriously too negative for Tom Cruise.
That's right. He doesn't want to be a part of that. Oh, so that was fun. And we'll play a longer and slightly more serious segment after the song. And then we've got another. I tried to interject humor in it, but the guy wouldn't let me go there. I let him control the conversation, and he's a bit of a talker, so.
Oh, I haven't heard your dad speak in a long time. It's funny to hear.
Oh, that was my dad, actually, yeah. And he was my first interview, but I interviewed some other people that I know a little bit, and one of whom I didn't really know at all, but I know that he's quite a connoisseur of trains and one of the more prominent and prolific collectors in the area. So anyway, we got a tune?
We have tune.
Let's check it out.
Don't stand a chance in song. confidence is fall is your faith etched in stone. Neither could comfort you from the wild unknown. So bury your burning hatred like a hatchet in the snow. Darling, do not fear what you don't really know. If you have a broken heart or a battered soul, find something to hold on to let go. To help you through the hard nights like a flask filled with hope. Darling, do not fear what you don't really know. Cause it won't last, your worries will pass. All your troubles that don't stand a chance. And it always hurts the worst when it's the ones we love the most. Darling, do not fear what you don't really know.
Got a, like a calypso vibe to it.
Well, it was to me that was like a later years Paul Simon kind of composition.
Yeah, it definitely with the Ladysmith Black Mambazo bass player playing or something.
Yeah, I just thought the vocals were unique. I haven't heard anyone sing quite like
that.
Was
that a guy or a girl?
I think it was a guy. His name was Brett Denon, and that song was called "Darling, Do Not Fear."
You know what I mean? The calypso vibe.
Absolutely.
It had a little bit of a Mediterranean or a Caribbean rather kind of feel to the groove a little bit.
It just didn't have the steel drum. That's all it needed, and it would have been.
Yeah,
complete.
It could have been a real Caribbean kind of vibe. So something huge happened last week.
To some, it was something huge. I think to the world, it was kind of important to note.
Well, it's an interesting little footnote in the history of the Cold War and all kinds of other things. A great chess player named Bobby Fischer died. I know a lot of you probably heard about it, and to a lot of you, it probably didn't mean a great deal. But to
you might have heard the name Bobby Fischer, and it's not Eddie Fischer; it's Bobby Fischer.
That's right, and it's not Carrie Fisher's dad. It's
right.
To our knowledge, he's not related to Carrie Fisher at all.
I don't think so.
And if he were, she would deny it. Perhaps he might as well.
If he was related, she'd probably eat him. Have you seen her in a while?
Hey, ease up.
I'm sorry. Carrie Fisher is a big man now.
Oh, boy. John is so cruel.
I'd like to see her in the bikini now.
The little Return of the Jedi slave girl
that's
outfit.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, we all loved that. And she was really coked up during that whole movie, too.
I'm sure she was.
I heard some crazy stories about her. So, yeah, Bobby Fischer died. And I'm going to tell everybody why he means something to me. And, you know, John and I, are both aware of the bit of an insane, hateful man he turned into in his later years. But I used to run a chess club, and it was called, actually, quite funny and ironically, the Robert J. Fischer Memorial Chess Club. My friend Joe Brooks and I founded it in 1991, and our tagline was, "Not dead yet, but what has he done for us lately?" And in fact, John actually did a little poster for us, which I still have on disc somewhere, and John did our little logo, which was sort of a stylized woodcut knight with angel wings. Do you remember that?
I do.
And, you know, we did this club for a while in the area, and then it was, you know, we did it for like 3 or 4 years. But the really funny thing is, in 1992, Fisher came out of retirement to play Spassky again in Yugoslavia, and we took credit for that because we you know, used to say that he saw our tagline, you know, not dead yet, but what has he done for us lately? Yeah.
I'm not dead.
And
much
and he came out of retirement to play in Yugoslavia in 92 against Spassky to kind of redo their match 20 years later, which Fisher won. So that's my – I've read some biographies and some different stories about Fisher, so I know quite a bit about Fisher's history.
I'm not a huge Bobby Fisher devotee. I guess I keep using that word. But I think that he was an interesting character, and I'm always fascinated by people who are – extremely smart, but then otherwise have major dysfunctions.
Yeah, and he's, you know, as you pointed out in your little bit, that your little piece that you put on the blog, you know, it was rumored that he had a genius level intellect. And I mean, clearly his brain was wired to do those kinds of strategic tactical things. You know, he was really good at those little puzzles where there was one square missing and you slide them all around mm-hmm. and create an image. He could do those instantly because he could just analyze in his head and see, you know, 25, 30 moves ahead.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, Bobby Fischer died and the history of Fisher is something like this. You know, he was the youngest U.S. chess championship ever. He did it like at the age of 13 or 14. He was the youngest grandmaster ever until recently. But at that time, he was the youngest grandmaster ever, which he did it 1 year following his U.S. championship. So if he was 13 when he was U.S. championship, he was grandmaster at 14 or 14 and 15. I forget the exact years. You know, and then Fisher, you know, went on a tear through the chess community and he did very well in all international tournaments. And then what are called the candidates matches for the 1972 World Championship came up, and the candidates matches are the playoffs.
Right.
Yeah. And he did something which had never been done before and has never been equaled since. You know, when chess tournaments get played, there's an awful lot of draws and there's one or two wins and losses. So if there's 20 games, the score is something like 10.5, 9.5 when all is said and done. You know, really close. But Fisher, in the candidates matches, which are playing all the great players from all the countries in the world, he won 21 games in a row. One. 21 games in a row. And that's just unheard of. I mean, he was just crushing people. I mean, just chewing them up and spitting them out and laughing, you know? And then, of course, he went on to win the 72 World Championship against Spassky. And then he was going to defend. They do that every 3 years. They do that cycle every 3 years. So in 75, he was going to defend, but he made a bunch of, what's the word? He made a bunch of demands of the chess organizers that he wanted this, he wanted that, he wanted this, he wanted that. Some of which are actually things that are given now to the champions, but he wanted some rules changes and he refused to defend, so they defaulted it and gave it to not Spassky, but Karpov, Anatoly Karpov, who reigned for a few years, and then of course Kasparov came in But during those later years, Fisher joined some bizarre cult-like church, and, you know, he's
grew a beard.
Yeah, he grew a beard. He looked like the Unabomber, and, you know, he's very hateful. He himself is Jewish, being Jewish, but he's very hateful of Jewish people, and he's very hateful of the U.S. and its politics, and, you know, he says very, very controversial things, and, you know, he's just... what's the word? You know, he's just
bent.
He's a little bent. And then somehow they got him to play again in 92, but they were playing in Yugoslavia, which was waging a war with Bosnia at the time. And the U.S. and international sanctions were levied against Yugoslavia, and U.S. citizens were not allowed to do any economic activity in that country. But Fisher won like $3 million by playing Spassky again. And then he said some more hateful things against the U.S., and the U.S. Revoked his passport. And he did some more traveling, but right around the time when his passport was revoked, he ended up in Japan. And, you know, they swiped his passport, and a bunch of sirens went off because it was an invalid passport. So he was held in Japan for like 7 months in custody. And I'm sure he was treated well because of who he was, but he was held nonetheless. And the U.S. tried to extradite him back, but Japan wouldn't do it or something like that. And Fisher tried to get citizenship from Germany, and they said no. And then he hit up Iceland for citizenship, and they said, well, we'll grant you a temporary visa to enter the country. And Japan said, no, we need a real passport. We need a real proof of citizenship.
He had to pledge allegiance to Bjork.
Yeah, he did. And so anyway, Iceland gave him a complete citizenship with passport, and he finished his life the late 2004, 2005. He ended up in Iceland, and up until he died a few days ago, he ended up, he was living in Iceland. And so that's like kind of like the Fisher story in a nutshell, and it's just a shame.
Fisher nuts?
Yeah. And it's just a shame because it's just I hate wasted genius. I hate wasted talent, you know. John and I aren't going to certainly we're not going to sit here and defend the things he says, but much like that singer Cat Stevens, you know, right. I see Fisher and Cat Stevens and they're sort of contemporaries, you know. They were both big around 72. And I see them as two different people, you know. There's the genius chess master, grandmaster, Bobby Fischer, and there's the brilliant songwriter and singer, Cat Stevens. And then, you know, what they did later, it's almost like they're different people. So I think it's, you know, what do the religious people say? Hate the sin, love the sinner? Something
exactly.
Like that. You know, it's sort of like, I think we can look at guys like Cat Stevens and Fischer, the brilliances that they gave the world when they were active in their art form, and then unfortunately they devolved into something horrible, you know. I don't think Cat Stevens has said things quite nearly as bad as Fisher. I don't mean to compare them as equals, but
no, but you can see definitely like Fisher, Cat Stevens, Tom Cruise, when he, you know, he used to be a great Air Force pilot, and then Navy pilot, and then he
naval aviator,
you know, because at one time he gave us lots of joy in finding that need for speed, and then he just went off on the deep end, and now he's looking for space aliens.
yeah. So anyway, you know, Bobby Fischer, perhaps the greatest player of all time, certainly one of the top two. I mean, it's either Kasparov or Fischer. It's one of the two, and just like Tyson, Ali, each in their heyday would have been a hell of a fight. Fischer, Kasparov, each in their prime, would have been a hell of a grudge match over the chessboard. It would have been something to see.
Yeah, but it's interesting also to see that, you know, a guy like Garry Kasparov, who's actually highly functional. I mean, he's one of those guys who has the chess intellect, but at the same time, you know, he's politically active. He knows right from wrong. He's well spoken. He doesn't seem to go off on weird bends.
I read an article on chess players in Psychology Today once years ago, and something like 99% of them are introverts, and Kasparov is the extrovert. He is the exception to the rule in chess playing. And yeah, I mean, you know, he, according to FIDE ratings, FIDE is the international chess governing body, Federation Internationale Do HS, you know, the International Chess Federation, basically. And he has the highest rating ever recorded in FIDE, which is something like 2875. And prior to that, it was Fischer who was like 2835 or 2855. So if you're going by FIDE ratings alone, Kasparov was a stronger player, but Kasparov never beat 21 people in a row in the candidates matches and, you know, did anything like that. And
yeah, when you sent me that article about that, the thing that I found that was interesting is that a lot of the players, they're very strategic that way, where they will intentionally force a draw so that they can conserve their energy because they know they're going to be playing a lot of games.
Well, and
Fischer would not. He would not concede. He always wanted to win.
And beyond that, Fischer used to accuse the Russians were the chess-playing machine, just like hockey and many sports. You know, the Russian machine was unbeatable. And all of the great chess players of the world were, you know, the majority of them were Russian. And Fischer used to accuse them of drawing against one another, so you know, they're ending up with equal records if they draw with one another, but then conserving their mental energies to play him or play other people. This way it would be a Russian who would win.
And collusion.
People accused him of, he accused the Russians of collusion, and people accused him of paranoia. And in later years, we learned that that was true. The Russians actually admitted to that. So, you know, just because somebody's paranoid doesn't mean somebody's not following them, you know? I mean, a lot of the things that people believed Fischer was paranoid about in the 70s turned out to be true. And I'm not talking about space aliens or the Jewish occupation government or any crazy paranoia like that. Right. I'm talking about within the chess world. You know, he made some observations which turned out to be true.
Well, I bet the Russians loved their children, too.
Yeah, of course. So anyway, I just wanted to talk about Fischer briefly. And the other thing I wanted to talk about, and I know you watched a little bit of the show, is this new Mythbusters type show, which actually follows mm-hmm. Mythbusters on Discovery Learning Channel, whatever it is, Discovery Channel?
Discovery, yep.
Yeah. And it's called Smash Lab. And what they've done is they've taken the Mythbusters model, which is kind of talking beforehand about the things that they're going to try to prove or disprove, and then setting up some experiments and tests to get the science right and see if it's see if it's plausible or busted or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I watched two of them in their entirety, and I have a couple of problems with it. They've taken the Mythbusters model and they've ruined it. It's just not very interesting. And unlike on Mythbusters, on Smash Lab, they try to do one thing. You know, they'll attack four or five myths on one show, which keeps it, you know, very vibrant and alive. But on Smash Lab, they attack one problem. So it tends to be very drawn out and very long-winded. And, I mean, my first problem with the show is that the four hosts aren't compelling at all. You know, Jamie and Adam on Mythbusters are very compelling, along with their little minion geeks. And the four people on Smash Lab are just dullards, you know?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think is important to note is that Mythbusters, while it may be entertaining and people say, oh yeah, they're doing some really cool things, blowing stuff up, but really at its core, what Mythbusters is doing is demonstrating the scientific method every single time.
That's right.
They're coming up with some sort of theory. They exercise tiny little experiments, and then they do maybe big experiments, and then they come to a conclusion. That's the scientific method, but they're making it fun. And the thing that I noted in Smash Lab is that they're taking the scientific method and making it boring.
Yeah, it's really boring. And beyond that, though, the problems that they're trying to solve are things that intuitively everybody in the world already knows the answer to.
Yeah, lots of wind will blow down a house. Okay, yeah, next story.
Yeah, great. You know, in their first episode, they were trying to come up with, I didn't know this, but at the end of runways in airports, like the very end, like, you know, quarter mile is aerated concrete so that if the plane does lose its brakes and it shoots off the end of the runway, that last, you know, quarter mile of runway is low density concrete, so the plane's wheels will dig into it and crush it and slow it down.
I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that, but it's really interesting and it works. So their idea was to take aerated concrete and maybe fill the medians of highways with it to reduce head-on collisions, right? You know, so if somebody goes into the median, it'll slow them down a lot first.
Right.
And half of the Smash Lab team attacked that problem and the other half attacked it by, I guess their idea was to make the median guardrail out of that concrete, you know, maybe a 3-foot-thick piece of it or a 4-foot-thick piece of it.
The wall of death, I like to call it.
To absorb impact. And, you know, the people who wanted to build the median out of it ultimately learned that you need more than 3 feet of it to slow a car significantly enough to make the accident less impactful, right? And we already knew the answer to that, right? At every off-ramp of a highway, they have those barrels filled with sand or water to slow you down so you don't ram into the...
Those runaway truck things, yeah.
Well, I'm not talking about those, but you know how they have the barrels so you don't smash into the guardrail?
Yeah. And they got them at the point.
At the point, so you don't hit that. And, you know, we already know that they have like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 barrels of depth. So, I mean, intuitively, my brain reasoned that 3 feet isn't going to be enough. That would be 1.5 barrels. That's not going to slow you down enough. They put like 6 or 8 barrels there, you know, three wide, you know, to slow you down. So it's like they're proving something which we already intuitively know the answer to. And on the second Smash Lab, they postulated that if we coat a recreational, not an RV, but if we coat a trailer with carbon fiber and epoxy resin, it'll be more earthquake proof. Well, carbon fiber is one of the strongest, you know, new materials that exists. Of course it's going to make it. You know, they spent an hour proving that, you know, coating a trailer in this material is going to make it safer and, you know, less susceptible to flying debris, crashing into it and putting holes in it and whatnot. And I mean,
if you coated it in concrete, it would do the same thing. I mean, like you're saying, okay, this is a common sense thing. It's like saying, well, you know, if I fry something with an oil, it's going to brown. If I fry it in water, it's not.
Yeah, it's
we
like
have to prove that.
Let's take this bland pasta and see if adding salt makes it taste better, and then right. And then spending an hour doing it. And you know, I as much as I wanted to like the show, you know, I just think it's a stinker. I think it's going to bomb. It's just not working for me.
To me, it's almost exact same principle. You've got one quality show that does one formula. Why ruin it with a second one? Kind of like Survivor Man adding Bear Grylls on top of him.
Bear
is just
Grylls,
ridiculous.
Bear Grylls is the bomb.
Taking
anyway.
Some fake guy doing fake things in
a
fake...
Yeah, that's Survivor Man.
It's all awful. In a studio, kind of like the moon landing.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, there you go. We have another segment from the train show, and this is a slightly more serious one, so let's check that out. I'm standing here at the train show with one of Utica's most noted train collectors, Doc Gaffney. You're actually a board-certified physician, right?
Well, I'm a physician, and I'm a specialist in internal medicine, retired.
Retired. How long have you been retired?
Well, 20 years, to make it simple. Yeah.
Did you have your own practice, or did you work at a hospital?
Well, I had a private practice, and I also was active at all three hospitals when I was working, but in particular, the St. Elizabeth's and St. Luke's.
Now, how long have you been interested in trains?
Lifetime, I think, since I was 2 or 3 years old, literally. My memory doesn't go back that far, but my earliest memories are of trains, and I know I was given a train basically when I was 2 years old for Christmas, and so I think my interest in trains goes back to at least that, if not before.
And as an adult, you started collecting trains?
Well, actually, as a young boy, I would save my money from allowance and mowing lawns and shoveling sidewalks in the wintertime and whatnot. And every time I went out to buy Christmas presents for the rest of the family, I always bought one for myself. There were a number of stores in Utica at the time that sold trains, and I have boxes from Horks Ibbotson. Most people wouldn't have realized they were train sellers as well as fishing equipment.
That's right. For those who don't know, Utica used to have a lot of interesting industry, and we had some fishing pole and rod and gear manufacturers.
Biggest, I think. I think they were the biggest at one time.
Right, and they were called Horks Ibbotson, and I don't know, are those buildings still standing? They used to be standing.
I think they're gone, but they were over here on Lower Whitesboro Street near where PJ Green is now in that area.
Now, is it safe to say you have a pretty big train collection?
Well, I have a lot of stuff. It's never really gotten quite inventoried, so I can't answer that. I know people who have far more than I have, but I have my share. And mostly Lionel and mostly post-war, which is what I grew up with and what I always relished.
And you collect O-gauge?
Basically O-gauge, but I have a little bit of everything. I have one little Z train and an N train and HO so that people can see the different gauges. And I actually have Lionel came out with large gauge or G gauge, and I have a couple of those. But basically O gauge or O27.
Now, do you have a layout? Do you have an active layout that's running that you can play with and enjoy?
Nope, not really. I have a layout, but it's buried. Unfortunately, going to train shows like this back in the old days was detrimental to my layout, because I would come home with boxes and put them on top of the layout, and pretty soon you couldn't see the layout anymore, always with the plan that I would get the layout cleaned up and whatnot. But the stuff accumulated, and you finally realize that there's only so much room for stuff, and I ran out of room, so it's very hard to get the layout uncovered now.
Well, there's an old comedian who used to say you can't have everything because where would you put it?
Yeah, well, that's true, and I love that line. that was the straight guy, right, Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
Among others.
I have one last question for you today, sir. And since you are a physician, you may have some insight into this. I'm wondering if you've ever noticed a correlation between train collecting and mental illness.
Well, that's a good question, and I would say probably there isn't a correlation between train, although wives seem to think we're crazy. Basically, I've tried to sell a lot of my patients during the years who were who needed a hobby, so to speak, and a lot of young parents who had children coming along on the idea of trains, because I look at a train as a very multifaceted hobby. You can be an artist, you can be interested in landscaping or decorating either a train room or a layout, and or you can be a very mechanical person with designs and layouts, or a very electrical and now electronic type person with all sorts of gadgetry, or you can have just interest in paper, in the catalogs and the books and the magazines about trains, which improves our reading ability. And all of these things, constructing a table, all of these things have a great deal to do with development in many facets. I think anybody who grew up playing with trains and actually doing much with layouts has a better handle and can fix more things in their house than the average person. And I think the release from stress is great. There are a lot of adults in train collecting because there is release.
Well, you've been a really good sport today. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for giving me a chance to spew, to let out all my great feelings. I love trains. I think anybody who gets into it would love trains if they stuck with it for a year or so.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Wow, and there you go. Doc Gaffney, one of Central New York's biggest. You know, I tried to take it in the funny direction, you know, jab the train collectors a little bit with my mental illness comment, and he just wouldn't let me go there.
We're here with the first man on the sun. None other than our main man.
Speaking of people dying, it's Sacha Baron Cohen has officially retired that character and Borat. He won't be doing those for quite a while.
Well, I don't think he can anymore. I mean, how could you put those characters in the public and get away with the stuff that he got away with? Everyone knows them now.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
the gag would be lost.
So we got another tune?
We do.
Let's check it out.
and don't forget, thoughts will soon appear when they're met. Many will never know their power, they close themselves until the final hour. If you can't seem to find the source, keep on riding and just stay the course. It don't matter where your ideas from, crystallize your mind and become.
I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it. I want to see so I can be. I am, is me, so be it.
Wow, cool tune.
It's a big advertisement for that Sobe drink.
The tea, Sobe teas.
Yeah, so be it.
That was my friend Jeremy Shaw, writer of our theme song. The song's called, that song was called So Be It, but our theme song is called Hyperbole. But yeah, my friend Jeremy, really cool tune. I recorded and mixed that, by the way. And I love the guitar solo, really tasty. Some nice little stuff going on in that song.
Some raunchification in that.
Yeah, they kind of fool you into thinking it's all clean guitar, and then those really crunchy, mid-rangey come in. But yeah, cool tune. I think we have our third segment from the train show, don't we? Yeah, let's listen to this one. This one's kind of fun. Here I am standing next to one of Central New York's biggest and most well-renowned train collectors. What's your name?
Adam Burnett.
And what are you doing here today?
I'm the chairman of the 28th annual Toy Train Meet at Utica's Union Station.
The chairman, what duties does the chairman have to do?
Just about everything. I have to make sure I got to get everybody to set it up. Got to get everything in order. Got to make sure everything goes well. Have everything come out without a hitch.
Are you responsible for the embezzling that's been going on at the train show for the last few years as well?
I have no comment at this time.
Now, you know, a lot of people are into toy trains and, you know, the Lionel and classic trains. Are there any people here who are into real trains as well?
Yeah, me.
Oh, what is it you do with real trains?
I'm a conductor and engineer on the Adirondack Scenic Railroad.
Really? Is that a lot of fun?
Yes, it is.
Well, what is the Adirondack Scenic Railway? Tell us about that.
It's a tourist excursion that goes from Utica, New York to Thendara, New York. It's a 52-mile trip, runs in the summer and in the fall.
Really? It doesn't run in winter?
No, it doesn't.
So you're actually an engineer. You get to toot the horn and push the throttle and all that?
Yeah, so I get to do all that fun stuff.
Wow. Now, did you ever get really shit-faced and, you know, take it out for a speed run?
Nope. Not yet.
No? What about, like, load up on, you know, marijuana and, like, do some scotch and then maybe try to pop some wheelies?
They do that out west.
Really? Who does that out west?
They do.
Who's they?
Them.
All right, he's not being specific here. Well, anyway, thank you, Adam, for your time, and we'll be seeing you around.
All right, I'll see you, and I'll be listening.
Actually, Adam is one of our podcast listeners. He's one of our few Central New York listeners.
Yep,
and there you go, the last segment.
He'll be watching us.
From Utica's Union Station. And the show's running really long, but I want to mention very briefly a film that I saw a couple weeks ago called Into the Wild. And it's the Sean Penn film based on the John Krakauer book Into the Wild about... this kid, Christopher, who idealistic and wanted to go live the wildlife up in Alaska.
Not like Girls Gone Wildlife.
No, this is like moved to Alaska with, you know, very little food and very few survival skills.
And not like fondle bear poop.
And then try to survive. And he ends up dying up there, which is quite tragic. But this film tells the story. And I don't know, I didn't read the book, so I don't know how much of this was fictional or non-fictional, but I mean, this is directing at its best, you know, in terms of storytelling and pacing. I mean, Sean Penn was just brilliant. I mean, it's a 140-minute film, very compelling. It, again, the test of how interesting a film is to me at Munson is how often I look at my watch, and I just was mesmerized by this film from beginning to end.
He didn't have to look at his watch because there was a watch in the corner of the film.
That's right. There was a little clock just showing. Now, I mean, mean, just very briefly, the actors that were in this were amazing. The kid who played Christopher was Emil Hirsch. Not too familiar with him, but his parents were played by William Hurt and Marcia Gay Harden. I've always loved William Hurt. I think he's great. Marcia Gay Harden's great. And two minor performances, not quite as prominent in the film, but amazingly brilliant, were Vince Vaughn, who actually is a wonderful actor.
He is a good actor.
And Hal Holbrook, one of my favorite actors. And I think he's up for a Golden Globe or Academy Award or something for this performance. Hal Holbrook's been one of my favorites since I saw the film Capricorn 1, that we didn't go to Mars film from the
70s. I was just mentioning that. I told you that the whole thing was staged.
Yeah. So anyway, I cannot give enough erect appendages to this film. I mean, this was phenomenal. You should really take time out of your schedule to see this amazing piece of work by Sean Penn called Into the Wild. So check it
out. Sean Penn's turning out to be a decent director as opposed to actor.
Well, I think he's both, but anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, I think that's a show, man. Well, all right. It's a done deal. Anyway,
it's done. It's like a runaway train almost.
You've been listening to another episode of Bloodthirsty Vegetarians. This is Rich Wilgus, and we're back, kind of.
John Tallarico.
John's cracking free.
I'm cracking free. This is a cracking free zone.
And I'm crack free. And check us out on the web, www.bloodyveg.com.
Check out the forum, bloodyveg.com/cracking.
And /forum. And you can leave us email to feedback@bloodyveg.com or cracking@bloodyveg.com.
That's right.
And I think that's... We got nothing left.
I got nothing for you.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time. And remember, you're listening to the VIB.